Hey everyone, Daniel here. So glad you could join us for Season 3 of The Jewish Story. Just a warning that this episode contains some disturbing content, so younger listeners or listeners with certain sensitivities may prefer to skip certain portions. Hello everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of The Jewish Story, a Jewish history podcast for the 21st century. In this show, we'll take a look back at the history of the Jewish people, relying on historical documents, archaeological artifacts, and linguistic data to paint a picture of the past. Over the course of last season, which took us from the year 70 to 1100 CE, we saw the rise of two major world religions, Christianity and Islam, and watched them completely transform what it meant to be a Jew in the world. We watched as Jews in different times and places rebelled, assimilated, submitted, and sometimes rose to become powerful figures. By the end of the 11th century, in the region of Ashkenaz, a small group of Jewish merchants had grown into a flourishing and expanding new Jewish community. To the east, the Jewish Khazari kingdom had risen and fallen. And within the Muslim Empire, with its dueling Abbasid and Umayyad caliphates, Jews were both discriminated against and, in some cases, respected as political leaders. As the ascetic militant Almoravids swept down on Muslim Spain from the Atlas Mountains, the Jews felt their dhimmi status threatened, and a new wave of anti-Semitism began to rise. And, at the very end of last season, I hinted at the changes that were beginning to take place in the Christian world. But as we move into the second millennium, things are changing fast. The vast empires that had risen over the past 1,000 years were beginning to crumble, and life was becoming increasingly complicated for the Jews. This season will be an exciting whirlwind filled with triumph, despair, scholarship, discovery, and many Jewish heroes. In order to lay the groundwork for this season, it will be important to take a step back and get a sense of the state of the world at the time this season begins, working our way from west to east. Western Europe at the turn of the 11th century was experiencing massive political change, fueled by competition between its Christian and Muslim populations. Remember that at the end of last season, the Muslim Almoravids had gained control of almost the entire Iberian Peninsula, leaving just its northernmost tip to a few small Christian kingdoms. But beginning in the 8th century, these Christian kingdoms, along with the large Frankish kingdom to the north, launched a campaign to reconquer the Iberian Peninsula and return it into Christian hands. This military effort, called the Reconquista, or Reconquering, was gradually successful in pushing back the Muslims, and resulted in the creation of some new Christian kingdoms. These included the kingdoms of Leon, Castile, Navarre, and Aragon, which we will hear more about later on this season. As the Reconquista was underway, things in Muslim Spain were becoming increasingly tumultuous. The Fitna, or Civil War of Cordoba, which we heard about last season, was in full swing, ultimately causing the Caliphate of Cordoba to fracture into a number of independent territories, called taifas, such as the Berber taifa of Granada. North of the Iberian Peninsula, the kingdoms of England and Scotland had been established in the same place that we know them today. Just east of France, the Western Roman Empire, now known as the Holy Roman Empire, extended from France's eastern border all the way into the boot of modern-day Italy. Immediately east of the Holy Roman Empire, extending all the way to Eastern Europe's border with the Middle East, lay the Byzantine Empire, whose power had begun to wane. Just east of the Byzantines, a number of Muslim Turkic tribes were gathering steam, particularly a group called the Seljuk Turks, who we will hear more about shortly. Even farther east lay the kingdoms of Hungary, Poland, and various others, and in the far, far east, the famed Chinese dynasties ruled. By this point in history, Jews could be found all throughout Europe and the Middle East, through much of Africa, and had begun migrating to the Far East, along the famous Silk Road trade routes into India and China. In order to understand what happens next in our Jewish story, we will need to review what had become of the Roman Empire by the turn of the millennium. Remember that Rome had begun as a republic in the 4th century BCE, and by the 3rd century CE had grown into an absolutely massive empire. Its enormous size prompted Emperor Diocletian to split the empire in half, appointing separate leaders to govern the east and west. This created the system of governance known as the Tetrarchy. The splitting of Rome ultimately led to its fracturing into two distinct powers, the Western Roman Empire in the west, and the Byzantine Empire in the east. After some east versus west conflict, Constantine, the son of the first Western Caesar, ended up conquering all of Rome, converting to Christianity, and making it the official religion of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire remained united under Christianity for decades, until Emperor Theodosius I once again split the empire in two, leaving one half to each of his two sons. From that point on, the Western Roman and Byzantine empires slowly began to diverge, with each one cultivating its own unique religious traditions. In the Western Roman Empire, religious practice tended to follow the classic Roman style. The church used Latin for their religious services and used unleavened wafers for the Eucharist. For those Jews who may not be familiar, the Eucharist is the ritual blessing of bread and wine, which are thought to then transform into the flesh and blood of Jesus. The Western Roman Empire looked to the Pope as their primary religious leader, and their churches were full of statues and images of various characters from the Bible. In the Byzantine Empire, by contrast, things were done differently, leaning more on classical Greek tradition. Byzantine church services were held in the Greek language, they used leavened bread for their communion, and they strongly disagreed with the West's use of graven images, citing the commandment in the Old Testament banning the worship of idols. These religious differences between East and West naturally created a bit of tension between the two territories, but the bowstring tightened in 800 CE when, as we learned about last season, King Charlemagne of Francia was crowned Holy Roman Emperor. This new title of emperor rubbed the Byzantines the wrong way. After all, they already had their own Eastern Roman Emperor, and they viewed the crowning of a second emperor in the West as a challenge to their authority. Fortunately, this dispute was temporary, as after Charlemagne's death, the Holy Roman Empire in the West fractured, and the title of Holy Roman Emperor disappeared for a while. But in the mid-10th century, a second Holy Roman Emperor was crowned in the West, another Frankish king named Otto. With one fell swoop, the conflict between East and West was reignited with a passion, and you better believe the Byzantines had something to say about it. Not long after Otto was declared emperor, the Byzantines officially declared their authority and superiority over the Christians of Western Rome. Needless to say, this one-upsmanship on the part of the Byzantines did not sit well with the Western Romans. In 1054 CE, in retaliation for their proclamation of supremacy, Pope Leo IX sent a formal delegation from Western Rome to the Byzantine capital of Constantinople to politely tell them to go to hell. With this delegation, the feud between East and West, between the Greek and Latin Church, and between the Byzantine and Holy Roman Empires solidified and formally became known as the Great Schism. The Great Schism marked a turning point in Christian history. For the first time, the Christian church was formally separated, and not only that, but they were actively antagonistic towards one another, and would remain that way for decades. As it turns out, this schism would spell big trouble for the Byzantines. As the decades passed, things began looking up for Western Europe. Its population was booming, and its economy was thriving. Forests were being cleared to make way for big markets, large trading networks were organized, and its borders were gradually pushing outward. As its territory grew, Western Rome began to challenge Muslim dominance over shipping routes in the Mediterranean, further booming the Western European economy. But at the very same time, things were looking bad for the Byzantines. Both their economic stability and their physical borders were being threatened by constant invasions from the east, where a Turkic tribe was rapidly growing. The tribe in question had initially migrated east from the Khazari kingdom in the mid-8th century, and settled in the pasture land there. Shortly thereafter, a former Khazari general named Seljuk, who had likely converted to Judaism earlier in his life, led a small band further east, where they converted to Sunni Islam. Seljuk's group slowly began to grow, gaining followers particularly from refugees fleeing warfare between various nomadic tribes on the east coast. By the year 1040 CE, the Seljuks had proven themselves as fierce warriors, winning a number of battles with neighboring Turkic tribes. They continued to gain territory, eventually establishing an empire which was slowly creeping up on the eastern border with the Byzantines. As their borders met, the Seljuks began to conduct raids on Byzantine cities, sacking many of them. The Seljuks may have initially been viewed as a small, pesky problem, But by the mid-11th century, they had officially toppled the Abbasid Caliphate in the east and become a legitimate political and military threat. In 1071 CE, the Seljuks won a major battle against the Byzantines at the city of Manzikert, devastating the Byzantine army there. This defeat created an open passage through Christian-controlled Asia, leaving it wide open for Turkic occupation. The Seljuks continued to push southward, and 15 years later, in 1085 CE, they took the city of Antioch from the Byzantines, a crushing defeat. The capture of Antioch signaled huge trouble for the Byzantines, who feared that they might lose their empire altogether. And so, in a move of desperation, the Byzantine emperor Alexius Comnenus asked for help from his former nemesis, Pope Urban II of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, based on the fierce competition between Eastern and Western Rome, you might think that Pope Urban would have turned up his nose at this plea for help. But, believe it or not, the Pope was actually pretty enthusiastic to lend a hand. First off, he likely saw this as a golden opportunity to reunite the two churches, and may have felt a bit smug seeing his nemesis on his hands and knees begging. Furthermore, the Pope was involved in some of his own scandal at the time, and may have seen this potential conflict as a welcome distraction for his subjects. Finally, the idea of religious pilgrimage had become quite a fad in Western Christianity, particularly to the destination of Jerusalem. But as the Seljuks' power and territory grew, travel to Jerusalem had become increasingly dangerous for Christians. So, in November of 1095 CE, Pope Urban held a meeting of the bishops of southern France called the Council of Clermont. At this council, the Pope formally commanded his Christian subjects to march east into Byzantium in order to help their Christian brothers push the invading Muslims out of their land. As incentive, the Pope declared that any Christian who lent a hand would be forgiven for all of their sins. These great marches toward Jerusalem to rid the land of the Muslims would come to be known as the Crusades. Pope Urban's intention was that the First Crusade would be led by a group of knights, who would set off sometime in 1096 CE. However, his call to arms at the Council of Clermont went absolutely viral and rapidly ignited into an inferno. All sorts of people came out of the woodwork, whipped into a zealous rage by the Pope and various other Christian leaders, like Peter the Hermit. This explosion of religious fervor likely occurred for a few different reasons. Firstly, the Gregorian reform movement of the Church, which had taken off in recent years, meant that the Pope had assumed a much more central role in society and held much more power. So, when Pope Urban made his pronouncement, all ears were on him. Furthermore, several new ideas had begun to creep into Christianity, which fit just perfectly with the Crusader mission. The idea of holy war, which was prominent in Islam, had begun to circulate in Christian circles, such that going to battle to defend Christianity was seen as pleasing to God. There had also been a resurgence of interest in the idea of the coming of days, a corruption of the ancient Jewish idea originating from the Apocrypha. The Christian legend was of a last emperor, commonly thought to be the final successor of King Charlemagne, who would lead the faithful to Jerusalem to await the second coming of Jesus. Anyway, all of these stars aligned to make people go absolutely nuts for this crusader idea. The First Crusade of knights, plus a ragtag army of commoners known as the People's Crusade, set off from France in around 1096 CE. Now, it may not be obvious at this point why the Crusades are relevant to the Jewish story. Well, although the primary motivation of the Crusades was to take Israel back from the encroaching Muslims, the religious fervor, a sort of madness that took over the Crusaders, meant that any non-Christian they could lay their hands on was a target for abuse. Remember that prior to the Crusades, the view of Christians toward Jews was mainly based around Augustine of Hippo's concept of the doctrine of witness. This idea was that Jews should be allowed to continue to roam the earth in order to keep the Old Testament alive. A later corruption of the idea also painted Jewish existence, which by this point was increasingly difficult, as a punishment for their imagined part in the death of Jesus. Furthermore, if the Jews were to be exterminated, the great conversion that was promised to occur prior to the second coming of Jesus wouldn't be possible. For these reasons, just a decade or so prior to the First Crusade, Pope Alexander II had expressly forbidden the killing of Jews. In addition to all of these religious reasons, however, Jews were just plain useful. As per the ruling of the Pope, Christians in the West were not allowed to lend money to other Christians at interest, making moneylending a poorly profitable job for Christians. There were other groups in the area who offered moneylending services, but because Jews were the lowest rung on the social ladder, they were forced to charge the lowest interest. This made them the most desirable moneylenders, which became a major occupation of Jews in the Holy Roman Empire. All of this meant that, until the Crusades, Jews were not treated too terribly in the West. They were allowed to travel freely, to build synagogues, and had the right to self-government within their own communities. However, they were excluded from many professions and trades, with medicine and moneylending being two of the only possible occupations for them. Anyway, the Crusaders set off for Jerusalem in 1096 CE, with fire in their eyes and an intention to kill any non-Christians they laid their sights on. As they moved southeast across Europe, a wave of brutality and murder followed. First, and hardest hit, were the Ashkenazi cities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz along the Rhine River. We have numerous sources which detail the horrors of the Crusades, including church records, writings of Christian historians, as well as Jewish written sources from throughout Eastern Europe. The Crusaders arrived in the city of Speyer in the month of May, right around the time of the Jewish holiday of Shavuot. They entered the city in a murderous rage and immediately set themselves upon the Jews. The leader of the Jewish community in Speyer, along with the city's bishop, collaborated to bring all of the Jews of the city into the fortified court of the Episcopal Palace and eventually tried to usher them to a safe haven outside the city. Anyone who threatened the Jews had their hand cut off as a means of deterrent. However, the madness of the Crusaders was just too much. Any Jew who was found outside of the safety of the palace was given the choice of forced conversion to Christianity or a painful death. Many chose conversion, but others martyred themselves. Unlike Speyer, whose people tried to protect the Jews from the onslaught, life was harder for the Jews of Worms. Even before the Crusaders showed up, anti-Jewish propaganda had been swirling around the city, particularly a story about a group of Jews who were said to have boiled a Christian alive and then poured the remains into the city's water supply. The Jews, accustomed to such hateful rumors at this point, heard of the approach of the Crusaders, but refused to believe that they were in any real danger, so many carried on with their daily lives. However, when the Crusaders stormed the city, the Jews quickly realized how wrong they had been. They clamored to get to safety within the bishop's palace, which was besieged by the Crusaders, and by many of the Wormians who eagerly joined in. By the time the Crusaders marched on, over 1,000 Jews in the city had been slaughtered. The city from which we have the greatest number of Jewish accounts was the next on the Crusaders' path, the city of Mainz, an old and thriving center of Jewish life. By the time they arrived in Mainz, the group of Crusaders had swelled to an army of nearly 12,000. As had occurred in both Speyer and Worms, the city's bishop ushered as many Jews as he could into his palace and cathedral. The Jews could only wait and watch as the Crusaders tore through the Jewish quarter, plundering their homes and then setting the entire quarter on fire. The Crusaders finally arrived at the palace gates, and the Jews were able to hold them off for a couple of days, but ultimately the palace gates were breached, and every Jew inside was slaughtered. From the Jewish accounts of the attack at Mainz, we hear many shocking and devastating stories of individuals who braved the Crusaders. These accounts include the 12th century writing of Shlomo Bar Shimshon, the writings of Rabbi Eliezer Bar Natan, and an anonymous writer. One of these accounts tells the story of Mistress Rachel and her family. As the Crusaders approached, Rachel's daughters sharpened kitchen knives, which their mother then used to slit their throats in order to save them from brutal torture by the Crusaders. Once her daughters had been killed, Rachel's son cried out, "Mother, mother, do not butcher me," and tried to hide. But his mother pulled him out of hiding and killed him as well, cradling him in her arms as he died. It wasn't long before the Crusaders finally found Rachel and brutally murdered her. The story ends with Rachel's husband returning home to find his entire family dead and committing suicide himself. Another story is that of a synagogue caretaker named Yitzchak Bar David. As the Crusaders were tearing through the city, his family was in dire straits, His wife had been murdered by the Crusaders, and his mother was lying in bed dying from her wounds. Isaac agreed to accept Christianity rather than be killed by the Crusaders, but ultimately deeply regretted his decision. To repent, he brought his daughters to the synagogue, murdered them in front of the ark, and sprinkled their blood over it like a sacrifice. He then returned home and set his house on fire with his dying mother inside it. Finally, to complete this disgusting ritual, he turned to the synagogue and lit it on fire with himself inside, burning to death. These stories are deeply horrific, but the Jewish story of the First Crusade is not all meekness and martyrdom. As you might expect, some Jews stood their ground and tried to fight back. In Mainz, a group of women gathered up stones and hurled them at the oncoming Crusaders in an attempt to stave them off. And in Cologne, as well as some other cities, Jews would offer the Crusaders meals and supplies in order to persuade them to leave the Jews alone on their way to fight the Muslims. The First Crusade was over by July of 1099 CE, when the Crusaders finally breached the walls of Jerusalem. It is important to understand that the brutality of the First Crusade actually had very little to do with the Pope and kings of Western Europe themselves. It was, in fact, mostly due to the wild fanaticism of the Crusaders, which could not be controlled even by those in power. By and large, the kings of Western Europe were actually furious at the massacring of Jews in their kingdoms, and were not shy about saying so. For example, in 1097 CE, Henry IV, King of Germany and Holy Roman Emperor, issued an edict which allowed any forcibly converted Jews in his kingdom to revert back to Judaism. His son, Henry V, felt the same way, and attempted to ease some of the anti-Jewish legislation in order to encourage Jews to resettle along the Rhine. King Louis VII of France, too, was critical of the fanaticism of the Crusaders, and many French church leaders, although still vehemently anti-Semitic, forbade the physical assaulting or murder of Jews. Eventually, Jews did slowly return to settle in the Rhineland, resuming their Jewish lives. As you can imagine, the First Crusade made a huge impact on the Jews of the Rhineland, and, as it turns out, 11th century Ashkenaz was home to a particularly notable group of Jewish scholars and rabbis. These Jewish scholars are today known as the Rishonim, or the First Ones, and are well known for completing three major religious projects. The first of these was to create a complete commentary on the Tanakh and Talmud to help modern Jews interpret and understand the texts. The second was the counting of the mitzvot laid out in the Torah. This is ultimately where we came to the number 613. Finally, a group of the Rishonim were focused on organizing the mitzvot by topic, for example, collecting a definitive list of the laws of kashrut, which were sprinkled throughout the Torah text. All of this was fundamental work in Judaism, and would go on to define Jewish halakha, or law, to the present day. As it happens, one of these scholars would become one of the most famous Jewish thinkers in history, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, more commonly known today as Rashi. Rashi was born in 1040 CE in the city of Provence, in the Champagne region of southern France. He was initially educated as a trader and businessman, but received a very thorough and broad-based education in all sorts of fields, including metalwork, horticulture, farming, and textiles. This secular education continued until the age of 25, at which time he married and moved from France to the Rhineland, where the First Crusade would take place just a decade or two later. In the Rhineland, he studied with famous Jewish scholars and brought all of his Jewish learning back with him to his birth city of Provence, where he established his own school of Jewish learning in 1070 CE, which quickly grew to eclipse the learned centers of Eastern Europe and become the most prominent Jewish learning institute in Ashkenaz. Rashi was not only a scholar, but also a family man. He had three daughters named Yocheved, Miriam, and Rachel, one of whom seems to have acted as his personal scribe, helping him to pen some of his most important work. By far his most famous body of work was his illustrious commentary on the entire Tanakh and Talmud, which became so famous that today, when Jews study the Torah, we do it using the two-finger method, one finger in the text of the Torah, and one finger in Rashi's commentary. Rashi was in fact alive through the entire First Crusade, and ultimately died 6 years after its completion, in the year 1105 CE. The devastation of the First Crusade had a major impact on all of the Jews of Ashkenaz, both because of the significant trauma it had caused and due to the long-lasting anti-Jewish sentiment that pervaded Western Europe long after its end. These impacts are captured by some famous Jewish writings produced in the 11th century in Ashkenaz. The first of these is a famous prayer which is still recited in synagogues today, the Av HaRachamim. The beginning of the prayer reads, Father of mercy, dwelling on high, in great mercy will take account of the pious and the upright and the pure, the holy congregations who gave their lives sanctifying God. They were loved and adored in their lives, and in their deaths they were not divided, swifter than eagles, stronger than lions, to do the will of their Maker and the wish of God. A second important Jewish literary work written just after the First Crusade was the Kuzari, written by Yehuda Halevi, the Jewish doctor and poet who we met last season. A passage from this book beautifully sums up the prevailing sentiment of Spanish Jews at the time, trapped between the Crusaders and the Almoravids. My heart in the east, but the rest of me far in the west. How can I savor this life, even taste what I eat? How, in the bonds of the Muslims and Israel chained to the cross, can I do what I vowed to and must? Gladly I'd leave all the best of Grand Spain for one glimpse of the ruined temple's dust. And that's where we'll end this episode, with the Crusades raging across Ashkenaz, the Almoravids ruling in Spain, and the Jews, as usual, caught in the middle. Next week, we'll meet some of the greatest Jews of all time and see what happens next